This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hello and welcome to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're a mom, do you ever feel like motherhood is a cycle of never-ending tasks that go unnoticed and unappreciated? If so, you are definitely not alone. Being a mom is one of the most important and rewarding jobs you could ever have, but it can also be tiring and emotionally draining. In our second segment today, we're going to be talking about seven mom traps that women often fall into and some step-by-step advice on how to avoid and escape those traps in your own life. My guest is the creator and editor of MomLifeToday.com, which is a website where she's gathered a diverse group of moms who are as passionate as she is about equipping others to thrive in their daily mom life. But in our first segment, we're going to be talking about taking control of your life in a slightly different way. And that is specifically for people who have diabetes or may have diabetes or are pre-diabetic. My guest, when he was 22 years old, had been binge eating so much that he was 60 pounds overweight and had become a full-blown diabetic. We're going to be talking with him about how he turned his life around and how you can do exactly the same thing. We'll be covering things like how to conquer your emotional eating, how to control stress, how to find alternatives to those weight-gaining inducing prescriptions, and how to stop diabetes in its tracks and even reverse it. And in the second half of today's show, after those first two interviews, we've got another couple of terrific interviews for you. The first one is with the Sergeant Major of the Army, Raymond Chandler, and his wife, Jean Chandler. And they've got a fascinating story, which is also a very inspiring story, as far as I'm concerned, about how they dealt with, as a family, the Sergeant Major's post-traumatic stress, and also how the Army can deal with post-traumatic stress as we keep bringing home more and more service members who are suffering from it. And after that, we've got a little bit of a lighter interview with the National Military Family Association. All that and a lot more is coming up in today's show, so stay right where you are.
Looking for the best all-you-can-eat buffet for only $1.99? Come to Big Ed's Chow House. But if you're looking for Big Ed, don't come to Big Ed's Chow House. Big Ed passed away last week at 47, leaving his wife and children struck down in his prime by the same disease that got his father, so he won't be around for his family. And sadly, it could have been detected early with a simple test, but Big Ed didn't get it.
Have you gotten the medical test you need? For a list of tests every man should have, go to AHRQ.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Erin Snyder, who is the author of The New Diabetes Prescription, The Diet, Exercise, and Mindset Revolution. Erin, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's great to be on.
Let's talk about the mindset part of this. I'm kind of curious about how a mindset can influence diabetes.
Well, sure. When we're talking about type 2 diabetes, we're talking about a group of people who have a lot of weight that they need to lose. In fact, it is the number one way that you can control this disease. And all of these people, they go to the doctor, they tell, well, you know, your blood sugar is tested high, it's greater than this number, you have type 2 diabetes, and so, you know, I'm going to give you some medicine.
Type 2 being adult onset, right?
Type 2, you know, it used to be called adult onset, but with the rampant number of children who now have this form of diabetes, that number no longer applies. That's what makes it so scary. So what they usually call it now is non-insulin-dependent diabetes, to distinguish it from type 1, which is purely insulin-dependent diabetes.
Okay.
But, you know, when you get an individual, whether it's a child or an adult in this situation, a doctor's going to say, you know, you need to eat better, you need to lose weight, you need to exercise. And the first statement is, duh. You know, because you go onto diabetes websites and they say, you know, stop eating so many sweets, start eating better, start eating healthy meals. The answer, again, is duh. They know this. Every diabetic who is in this situation knows that they're eating too many candy bars, donuts, French fries, burgers. I was one of these people, and I was in this very situation. And that's where mindset comes in, is you need to look inside of yourself and identify that you are performing making these lifestyle choices on a day-in, day-out basis, and that this is what you need to work on to change them. And so what that means is you need to identify that when you are stressed out or when you are poorly slept, you are making poor food choices and need to make different ones at that moment. And so what I coach is I coach individuals to say, hey, you know, I want you to, you and I are going to come up with three meals that you can make and prepare and eat in under 10 minutes that have to be healthy, and that you're going to keep them in your pocket if you need to, so that when you're on your, you know, your nursing shift or when you're teaching in front of the classroom or when you're at your desk and you have to miss lunch, you don't miss lunch because you can reach into the pocket. And then 3 hours later, you're not reaching for a candy bar along with a large pizza. And it's that literal lifestyle choice that's being made again and again and again that is causing the weight gain, that is leading to the high blood sugar.
Well, how do you get people to the point where they will actually listen to you? Because it seems like like smoking. People have been told for their whole lives that
this
smoking will
there.
Kill you. And it's the same thing with this, right? You know that being overweight and being a diabetic, whether you're a diabetic yet or not, it'll kill you. And that doesn't affect everybody.
This is a great question. And, you know, you bring up smoking, which has a concept of addiction associated with it. And in type 2 diabetes, when we're talking about the foods that we diabetics have been perpetually eating to get ourselves to being so overweight that we are type 2 diabetic, it does have an addicting component to it, and science has now shown that you eat a lot of fat and sugar, it lights up the brain in the same way that it does when you're on cocaine. So yeah, what do you do? How do you bring somebody to that situation? Sometimes you have that mea culpa moment in the same way that alcoholics do, where they have some rock bottom moment that finally gets them to want to change. I was being interviewed by a type 2 diabetic man who gained, and he said it himself, 100 pounds in 1 year. And the interesting thing about that day during that interview was he said he never weighed himself, he didn't even look at himself in the mirror for a year. So picture that. You don't look at yourself in the mirror for an entire year. Not one time in a year do you see what's been happening to you. So there's this denial component to it where, you know, you're putting your metaphorical fingers in yours and going, la, 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 I don't want to know this.
Right.
And so sometimes that is what unfortunately has to happen. But if you have that message out there sooner or later, you know, you have that light on for people, you know, you're going to reach the ones who want to come towards that light, and you can help them out.
Aaron, is it possible, and I'm sure you get this kind of question all the time, is it possible to reverse diabetes so that you will not be a diabetic any longer?
You know, I am as close to that possibility as you can. I've got 8% body fat. I've had a pot belly my entire life. And so what does that mean? I'm not on many medications. I eat basically a low carb diet with a few carbs on the weekend. So you wouldn't know.
So like an Atkins kind of a thing?
And you know what I do is I follow low carb 5 days a week, and then I have a ton of carbs on the weekends and on special occasions, and so it allows me those breaks without forcing me to gain weight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a lifestyle choice that I teach to everybody in my program. It allows them to lose their weight and have cake too. But anyways, what happens? If I go back to my old way of eating, I'll go right back.
But are you checking your blood sugar a couple times a day and giving yourself insulin shots?
Have to take any insulin shots. I do not check my blood sugar during the time that I'm on a strict low-carb diet because, frankly, there's no need. However, if I'm going to, on a day, have pizza or something very sweet, I sure am checking my blood sugar about 90 minutes afterwards to make sure that I'm not overdoing it and if I need to make corrections.
So there is hope. In a way. I mean, because I think that's one of the things,
always,
you know, if you're an alcoholic, you can stop drinking and you'll still be an alcoholic technically, but you won't have the effects of it anymore. But with the diabetes, it sounds like there's always going to be, or in most cases, going to be some residual reminders.
Well, here's the great news, just from a purely medical standpoint. Study after study has shown, in fact, a 10-year study has shown that if a type 2 diabetic controls, or type 1, controls their blood sugar, they will not have any of the dire consequences of kidney disease, heart disease, high blood pressure, stroke, amputations, any of those scary scenarios. They'll be no more likely to occur to that type 2 diabetic than a completely diabetes-free individual. So you control your blood sugar, you control all the killers.
That's amazing. Okay. And it works, it's the same thing for kids and adults, or is there a difference in the way that you deal with kids and adults?
You know, there's the only other, you know, you deal with kids on a different level in the way that you deal with kids, but I mean, the same statistics apply.
Okay. So we talked a little bit about the diet part of it. Let's move to the exercise.
Gladly.
What are specific exercises that you're talking about that are different from just a regular workout?
Well, you know, they really are the one and the same, and there's no special exercises that are going to help you lose fat and control blood sugar better than any other exercise. The only caveat being that weight training, specifically lifting weights, has been shown to have a 1-2 punch when it comes to controlling blood sugar. It seems to help you lose weight faster, it increases metabolism faster, and it helps you control blood sugar faster.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. I mean, yeah. Does that work for non-diabetics also?
Oh, it's going to work for everybody the same, yeah.
Huh. Okay.
That's the good news. So, you know, the trick is, though, we come back to that mindset, is we have to get the individual to exercise. This is somebody who perpetually is not exercising. You know, you don't get type 2 diabetes right after you run the Boston Marathon.
Right.
It's probably
true.
Yeah. So, you know, it's who is the individual, you know, who behind these numbers that say that they are diabetic on that medical report. Is you have to introduce that into their life. And so you also have to remember, we're talking about somebody who may have 100 pounds to lose, 150 pounds to lose. I can't say, hey, let's get up on the ground and do some jumping jacks. You know, they may have specific joint problems. They may have back problems from living such a sedentary lifestyle. And these are things that we have to take into consideration when we're designing exercise programs, not even making it so they have to get up and down from the floor too many times. You know, we may do partial repetition exercises where they're squatting to half the distance that we would have a leaner individual squat, and then we gradually increase that resistance.
Sure.
Anything that they were willing to do and that they can do for a good 30 minutes to up to an hour per day is what is going to, over time, help them heal.
Aaron Snyder is the author of the new diabetes prescription, The Diet, Exercise, and Mindset Revolution, filled with all sorts of good stuff, including the diet part that we didn't really have a chance to talk about. But Aaron, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Have you ever had an experience with diabetes, say a diet program or an exercise program like the ones we've been talking about today, that stopped the progression of the disease or maybe even reversed it? If you have, let us know.
Sassy!
Today's episode, Bobcat in the Cave.
Oh, nuts! There's a bobcat in this cave! Save us, Sassy! You will, but first you'd like to stress the importance of cat adoption? Over 5 million cats go into animal shelters every year and they need to be adopted? Help us, Sassy! Why bother? We'll just get into more trouble tomorrow?
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Tracy Eister, who's the author of Be the Mom, Overcome Attitude Traps, and Enjoy Your Kids. Tracy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what are the attitude traps?
Well, I think, you know, I've heard people say there's a saying, attitude is everything. And I think sometimes when you're a mom and you go through your day and you're pouring into your children and spending time with your children and trying to figure out, you know, how do I raise these little people? Sometimes you're looking for, in a book or in conversations with other women, you know, just give me 10 things to do so I can figure out how to do this mom thing. And I think as I just went through my mom life and as I talked to other moms and part of the lives of other moms, what I started realizing is sometimes the reason we really have trouble with being a mom is just our attitude. We could just have an attitude that kind of overtakes us, and then it kind of tanks us in our mom life and prevents us from being the mom that we're supposed to be to our children.
Well, what is that mom that we're supposed to be?
Well, based on my experience, I feel like that we're supposed to be very intentional in our parenting, that, you know, anything else in life that you want to do and you do really well, you train for it. I mean, even, you know, learning to drive a car. And then in your career or whatever your vocation is, you know, you just don't decide one day that you're going to be a radio host and you go out and do it. You study how to be a radio host and how can I do that well. And so I think with motherhood, it's just something that you have to be intentional about, and you have to be a student of your child and understand who your child is and how God made your child and how you can help your child to be what they're supposed to be in life. And so you become a student of your child. So that's that intentional part, understanding how to be intentional in choosing what to do every day when you're with your children instead of just letting it happen. And then the other part to that, I think, is being a relational mom. Building a relationship with your child. I think it's important for mothers and fathers that you need to build relational equity with your child so that you can speak into your child's life as they continue to grow, and especially when they're tweens and teens, because that's when the stakes get higher, because mm-hmm. the world is pulling at them so much more,
sure.
and trying to market to them and convince them of things, and you want to still be able to speak into their lives at that age. So if you have this relational equity in mind and trying to be relational into their lives, then that's important, you know, when you get to those points when you still want to be the rudder and help mm-hmm. them understand and make decisions.
Now, do you think that this is possible for your average woman to do if she's working? Or does she have to be a stay-at-home mom to be able to do this?
I think it's doable for everybody. Two of my dearest friends are single moms. And then, you know, there are lots of people that I work with that are working moms. And I think, again, when you're at work, you work hard and you're intentional about what it is that you're doing. You know, if you're working outside the home, whether you're a work-at-home mom or a work-outside-the-home mom. And again, it's just that being intentional about it. And so when you get home, you know, you work hard at work. And I guess in a way what I'm saying is, well, work hard at home too. Be intentional and make it a point to – my one friend that's a single mom, for instance, she has a son that's a teenager, and he really is into knives and coin collecting. Now, those are two things that she's not so much interested in, but because she is, she enters his world, and she helps, you know, when he's searching for different coins online and looking for things, you know, she'll go and she'll help understand it with him and talk to him about it, and he has an eBay account, and she's an accountant, and so she's helped him learn how to – you know, have that account and set it up and work with money. And again, instead of kind of having, you know, her plan, she figured out what it was he was into and just got intentional and relational. So, yes, I think it's definitely doable for everyone if you just be intentional about it and, again, be a student of your child, understand what it is they're into, and just be part of their world.
Is there a place in there for them to be part of your world as well? Or is it all a one-way thing?
I think there's definitely place. What it's interesting that a lot of times if there's something that you're interested in, again, you're teaching your children how to do life. So when they see that you're interested in them and what they're doing, then also they're interested in you. If I'm off because I like to write, and if I'm off writing, hey, Mom, what are you writing? And, you know, my daughter from the time she was young would come in and check out what I was doing and why are you writing about that and what are you doing? And then that kind of made her interested in writing and reading. You know, she's a voracious reader because Mom was a voracious reader. And so I think because everything we do is modeling for our children, and we do want children that care about other people and that want to be relational. And so you can't look at it as because I know that trap that people talk about where being child-centric. I think child-centric is dangerous if you're teaching selfishness, but child-centric in I care about you and who you are and how God's made you and what you're supposed to be. And then in turn, you teach that child to do that same thing, because I see that in children, and my children specifically, that they care about their friends and what their friends are interested in because they just learned that concept at home.
You've got a chapter in the book called The Martyr Mom Trap.
Yes.
And I guess that fits right in with what you're talking about modeling. I guess if your kids see that you don't have any time for yourself, you mm-hmm. just are putting everybody else's needs first, in some ways that seems like the kids could take advantage of that, but I guess there's also the possibility that they could end up doing the same thing.
Right. Well, again, you know, if you have a child that is constantly grouchy or snarky or smart mouthy, one of the things I always kind of try to do is, well, you know, they spend a lot of time with me, and so is that something that I'm modeling for them? Because if you ever want to, you know, start to understand some of your own bad traits, you usually start seeing them in your children, and then you have to kind of figure out, okay, now that's not what I want to, you know, have them grow up acting like, so I need to understand, you know, how to model better for them. And I do think that you know, that's part of that martyr mom trap. If you have a whiny, fussy, I don't want to, whiny, nobody cares about what I want to do, you just have to recognize, is that something you're modeling?
Hmm. What does your husband think about all this?
My husband agrees. My husband, we are very much a parenting team. So I know when I called the book Be the Mom and it's all mom-centric, there are several places in there where I discuss. My husband and I have conversations and we have discussions and we decide how we're going to parent, and that's part of the intentional part. And then also I think moms have a role in their children's lives and dads have a role in their children's life. And I am, you know, very much a nurturer and he is very much a leader. And so there are things that I teach them in the nurturing mode, and there are things that he teaches them in the leadership mode. But I do think in parenting, you know, you have to partner with your spouse, and you have to decide what's working well in your home. And so he sees children that the interesting thing, especially with my son, there are times, you know, I have to call him up, okay, he wants to go snake hunting. Is that normal or scary? To me, that sounds scary. And husband says, you know, he's a boy and that's what he's going to do, and he's going to go out there and he's going to get dirty. So, yeah, I believe in the definitely we're in this together team parenting approach.
Now, what about the idea of good enough? That you can't do everything. You can't,
right.
I mean, even if you're trying to get to know your child and be intentional and all that, what you're talking about, that seems to be putting a lot of pressure on people in a way that, you know, is there a point where you can just say, look, I just can't do everything?
Well, I think because the message that I'm trying to give to moms is maybe not one they hear a lot, that part of what you do need to do is be relational, be intentional, and be selfless and pouring into your child and helping them become who they're supposed to be. Because I do think there are a lot of wonderful, excellent parenting messages out there. Because the letters I've been getting from moms have been, you know, I've been so weary and I've been so tired and it's given me a really bad attitude because I felt like I can't do it all. And the overarching message that they seem to be getting from Be the Mom and sort of the philosophy that I feel like I've been called to just tell people about is that that relationship does matter, that every chore doesn't have to be perfect, that every class doesn't have to be signed up for, that every sport doesn't have to be done, because that's always taking the children away and out of the influence of their parents. And I'm just trying to remind parents to be the mom, be intentional, be relational, spend time with your children, get to know them. God gave them to you for a reason. You study them every day. You know their personality exactly. And even, you know, whether it's teachers at school or other children that they play with, constantly reminding them that you're an individual and you are who you are for a reason. And God made you that way for a reason. And I believe in you, and I think that's just something that moms need to be reminded of.
Tracy Eyster is the author of Be the Mom, Overcome Attitude Traps, and Enjoy Your Kids. And her website is momlifetoday.com. Tracy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
There once was a boy wizard whose name was Larry Smarter.
Larry, why weren't you in Professor Dinky Doodle's mythical creature classification class?
Well, I'm taking Algebra 2 in a foreign language.
Oh, so you can talk to unicorns?
Exactly. Unless they're French.
Larry wanted to go to college, so he visited knowhowtogo.org to find the classes he really needed. Getting into college doesn't happen magically. Learn more at knowhowtogo.org.
Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation for Education, and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show on AFN. I'm Armin Brott. Our first interview in this part of the show is going to be with the Sergeant Major of the Army, Raymond Chandler, and his wife, Jean. And after that, we'll be hearing from the National Military Family Association. Great interviews both, so stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm here with Sergeant Major of the Army, Ray Chandler, and Jean Chandler, who is his wife. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Ready and Resilient program that you have. I was talking to Sergeant Major Filardo about it, and it sounded absolutely terrific. And then I've got some specific questions also for some of the issues that you've been through.
Okay. Well, honored to be here and spend some time with you and answer some questions about behavioral health and resiliency in our Army. And, you know, we've spent a lot of effort over the last decade in understanding some of the challenges for our soldiers and families associated with combat. And over the last 6 months or so, the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army has really put a emphasis on the health of the force. And the Chief, General Ray Oriarno, has announced that we would be pulling all of this together into what we call our Ready and Resilient campaign, which is to help our soldiers and our families become more ready and resilient. And that's going to help our Army be better than what it is today, and it's pretty darn good right now.
Now, a few years ago, then Secretary Gates had what I thought was a really interesting comment, which was something along the lines of the military will no longer hold it against a soldier for accessing mental health, which the no longer part was interesting because it was sort of an acknowledgement of, I think, what a lot of people had been fearing. And, I mean, to hear it from you and to hear it from Ray Chiarelli and some of the other very high-ranking leadership, it really makes a difference. Have you seen that in the soldiers that you've been working with?
Well, I think that Secretary Gates meant that, you know, the ways that we did things like security clearances, which asked questions which could lead to folks feeling that they weren't going to be cleared for a clearance, we were going to get away from that. There is still some concern in the force, still some stigma associated with reporting behavioral health. The fact that I'm in behavioral health care, for instance, may have some impact. But I can use my own story as the best analogy.
Yeah, please do.
I was in behavioral health care for a couple of years, pretty about once a week in behavioral health care. And, you know, in spite of that, or because of that, made me a better, you know, husband, father, and person, and ultimately a better soldier. The impact for me, the reason why it's important for me is I was asked that question by General Casey, the Chief of Staff of the Army that selected me for this position. He said, is there something that I need to be aware of? And I said, I've been in behavioral health care counseling for the past 2 years. And he said, well, I don't see that as an issue. I see that as a sign of strength. And so I'd like you to be able to talk about it if you feel that you can. And so that's one of the things I've chosen to do, is to say, hey, look, if I can tell my leader, the Chief of Staff of the Army in this case, that I'm in this counseling, he sees it as a sign of strength. He's going to select me for this relatively important position in the Army. Then any soldier can seek help and not have a fear of reprisal or stigma associated with that in their career.
That's got to be really inspirational, I would think, to see it coming from the top down. Gene, I wanted to ask you, I've done a lot of interviewing of people and a lot of research on post-traumatic stress and on soldiers returning home, and there's so much emphasis on the soldiers themselves and what they're going through and the impact that it's having, and the VA is doing wonderful work. But there isn't so much on how the soldier coming home, not the same guy who left, affects everybody else. I mean, I would hear from some mothers, for example, that their little kid would want to come up and hug daddy from behind, and he would spin around, and there could be those kinds of issues, which is exactly what you want in a combat situation, but that doesn't play out well in a living room. How was it for you to deal with having your husband return not quite the same as he was when he left?
I think that the Army has made huge strides in programming and in briefing about redeployment. For instance, back in 2004, I believe that it was, my debrief for Ray coming home was, your husband's going to come home and he's going to be different. And the best thing to do is not say anything for 8 weeks. It takes about 8 weeks for the soldier to reacclimate. And when Ray came home, he spoke really loudly you know, and kind of harshly. And I waited 8 weeks. I didn't say to begin with, don't talk to me that way. I waited 8 weeks. We have come so far since then. There is a wonderful resiliency training for spouses. There is a master resiliency trainer at every ACS that the Army has. I want to mention, too, for our Guard and Reserve families who are not, may not necessarily be near an Army base, I would recommend that they read Karen Rivich's book, which is called The Resiliency Factor. Dr. Rivich worked with the Army to develop the resiliency program for soldiers and families. And for children, there is a pediatrician called Dr. Kenneth Ginsberg, and he has a book out that's called Building Resilience in Children and Teens. And that, again, is a wonderful resource. Army One Source is a wonderful resource for all of our families, that if they need help or advice, they can go to Army One Source and find resources there.
But aside from keeping your tongue safely inside of your head for 8 weeks, what did you do to help you deal with the after effects? And also from the perspective of your children, were they seeing what was going on with Ray?
Our children were grown and out of the house. They're all grown, all six of them. No, I didn't really know anything about PTSD then, or TBI, or that he would be changed. It was just kind of like we limped along. And finally, you know, things came to kind of a head. And some behavioral health counseling later, but have also learned a whole lot along the way.
Were you also involved in the behavioral health counseling? Were you going along for the appointments? Because it just seems like addressing one side of it is not completely the whole thing. So you had, yes, you were there too.
Head part.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So the one of the things, you know, again, from my own personal experience, not talking, not involving myself in my work to the point where it really became the focus of my life and was a way for me to gain control over a sense of not having control. And, you know, I was very effective in camouflaging that from my family, including my wife. And you asked about our kids, you know. Some of our kids, I really kind of withdrew from and
Ray,
did
Ray,
not maintain
Ray really,
it.
Really, connection. And that was maybe one of the biggest changes was how he did withdraw. Mm-hmm. Instead of calling the kids every weekend, it would go longer, longer, longer. And Ray never did talk about his experience in Iraq, and part of my debrief was don't ask.
It was interesting. You said that you were camouflaging it from your family, and I'm wondering, from your perspective, Gene, was he? Because there's often a kind of self-delusion part of this where you think that you're keeping your family, but they know exactly what's going on.
I just knew that, you know, the focus of his life became his work. And, you know, that I am a professional, a marketing professional of 26 years, and so I focused on my work. And, you know, that's really a recipe for disaster. So,
Sergeant Major, were you aware, in your own mind, were you aware that there was a problem that needed to be addressed when you first came home?
Well, actually, yes, I did, but I did what I think anybody at that time frame would do. I had been given an assignment, another job from what I was doing when we redeployed, and if I was not able to leave where I was currently at, I would not be able to go to that new job. And it was, in effect, a promotion. So I didn't tell the truth on my post-deployment health assessment, which is what soldiers do when they redeploy. They have to go through reintegration training, and you have to go through some online self-assessment, and then a behavioral health specialist or medical person would review that and determine, you know, whether or not you needed extended treatment or whatever. I just didn't answer the questions completely truthfully, and that allowed me to get through and go on to what I was doing, thereby completely stuffing all of the underlying issues that I had had with my deployment. So, and then, you know, because for me personally, you know, I have been very good at doing that. you know, it became natural, and I was just able to keep that suppressed. And so if I spent my energy on work, I did not have to worry about that because it was stuffed and it was put away and I didn't have to worry about it. Unfortunately, as we went along and I went to other positions of increasing responsibility, the stress of that work became harder and harder for me to keep that in the box. So, you know, less physical exercise, drinking more, not eating as healthily as I probably should have, not talking with my best friend, you know, my wife, about what was going on. You know, it was all of the classic indicators of somebody who has a problem and is either, you know, self-denying or, you know, is stuffing it so that no one else sees what's going on.
So what was it like at the moment that you kind of made a switch in your brain and said, this is just not working out anymore, I'm going to go and see somebody? How did you process that whole thing?
Basically, I got to a point where my career, my family, and my marriage were all going to be sacrificed for pretty bad behaviors, and had to decide that I was not going to continue on the path I was and seek help. And, you know, Gene was a big part of that. So, you know, my marriage, my family are the most important things in my life, and I needed to get the help because what I was doing wasn't working. And I was doing some pretty, you know, bad things that all around were just not in line with what I say I'm about, which is to be a professional Army soldier, a person who believes in these list of values and has this ethos that I'm supposed to be living by, and also my own personal responsibilities and feelings towards my wife and family. I wasn't doing what I said I was supposed to do. You know, I wasn't doing the things that I said were important. I wasn't living my life the way that I had said I would live it. And so I had to make changes. And that took a long time to understand where it came from, what it was about, and then to understand about coping mechanisms and that I'm not a superhuman, that there are a lot of people that love me and care about me and want me to love them too. And finding out how to pull that together and recognize my own shortcomings and grow as a person took a couple years on about a weekly basis. And, you know, a lot of anxiety and a lot of tears and a lot of frustration and, you know, heartbreak and sadness. And I truly believe that our marriage is in a better place than it was, that I'm a better person, that I'm a better father, and ultimately I'm a better soldier. And, you know, just put a lot of people through a lot of heartache and pain over that. So,
Gene, after the initial 8 weeks of silence, were you participating in encouraging Ray to get the kind of help that he needed, or were you feeling that you couldn't talk about it?
My training back then was you don't ask any questions. When the soldier's ready to talk about his experience or her experience, they'll talk. But your role as a spouse is don't ask.
But that's not an effective way of dealing with it anymore. So what's the current thinking now?
Right. The Army has learned so much. And the briefings that spouses and families get before their soldier's going to come home is very robust. And they talk about, do training about PTSD symptoms, TBI symptoms, just a really robust... say right out loud, this person's going to be different. They went through war. And, you know, it's programming's like Strong Bonds, which is for couples and families. Units can decide to present a Strong Bonds. series, like 8 weeks after the guys and the gals get back, you know, to have that professional help and, you know, kind of shoring up that marriage again and reconnecting in that marriage and in that family. The resources and just the understanding on the part of the military services now. Back then, it was almost like they just didn't, nobody really realized how profound changes in PTSD could be.
How long ago was this?
This was back in 2004.
So you're, Jean, in a very unique position, obviously in a senior leadership position, and you have access to lots and lots of other military spouses. Are you feeling that you want to be out there and encouraging them to get involved in this process and to be as helpful as they possibly can?
Absolutely. And, you know, Ray and I travel to post camps and stations all over the world. And I talk with spouses and family programs when we visit. And I would say that to all of our spouses, that there are resources out there for you. You need to take the initiative and look for them, you know, and go to your ACSs, go online, go to Army OneSource, read books, you know, be proactive, because if I had known at that time where those resources had been available for me, I know that our life together would have been a lot easier.
So, Ray, I don't want to keep you guys all day, but I would like to get a sense from you of somebody's listening to this, a soldier in the field, whether a male or female, who realizes now, okay, look, the sergeant major of the Army says it's okay, I'm going to do it. How do they begin? I mean, you talked about the strong bonds, Gene, and that's through the chaplain corps, and I've spoken with some of the chaplains, but how do they even begin this process in a way that they can feel good about themselves?
Well, I think the first thing, and I want to make sure that we're clear about what we were talking about. It took 4 years for this to come to a head, basically from the time I redeployed in 2005 until 2009. And it's the strength of my wife and others that really kept our marriage together, kept our life together and our quality. No one needs to go 4 years. Okay, so the first thing is for a soldier to look, you know, one of our Army values is personal courage. And it does take personal courage to say, you know what, I need some help. It also takes personal courage for a family member or another loved one to tell their soldier, you may need some help. We may need some help. So if you are living those values that we place so near and dear to us and within the Army, one of which is personal courage. There's a lot of people out there that want to help. It's available to you. It can be confidential. But you got to be willing to put that foot forward, and that's a huge first effort. But once you do it, you know, a lot of that baggage you may be carrying around, a lot of that guilt or anxiety or sadness, you can start to let that go. And it's a very liberating, very self-fulfilling feeling to know that, you know, I'm actually better than I was back then. And in our Army, we're all about, you know, getting better all the time. You know, we put a tremendous amount of effort in looking at things that we're not doing as well as we want to, and to try and continue to make them better. That same thing applies to the human being, to the soldier. We want you to be better, and we've got all these tools. They're there for you. We're here to help. Just take that first step, and we're going to catch you, brother.
Well, where's the first step heading? Which direction? I mean, there's the chaplain option, and how do they go to their CO? How does it work?
You know, I think the most powerful way is between what we call battle buddies, okay, a person to your left or right that is looking out for you and you're looking out for them. You know, we have been fighting this war for a long time, and, you know, for that young soldier on the ground, most often they're going to tell you, I'm doing it for the person to my left or right, that battle buddy. So battle buddies, you know, be there. If you're concerned, you know, you got to ask that question, are you okay? You know, and then the next step is to really show care. You know, I'm concerned about you. You know, you're important, your life is important, and then really to help them to get to the place where they need help. So that could be anywhere from Military OneSource, which is a phone call, to going to the behavioral health care that we've now pushed down to the brigade level. You've been consolidated for a long period of time, usually around our hospital and medical treatment facilities, and we're pushing that down into the units so that there's more willingness or access in a place where soldiers are more comfortable with. It could be through some type of a support group. There are all kinds of support groups, both on and off post, that can help you. And then through some of our other programs, like our military family life coordinators, which are other care specialists that are at the unit level that can assist. So there's this plethora of places. I'd recommend anybody that was interested go to the Morale, Welfare, and Recreation website. Your Army Community Services has a whole laundry list of different places to receive support. And at the end of the day, you know, if you just ask that question, we're going to get you where you need to go.
And Gene, would you recommend pretty much the same list of things, or are there some additional resources or options that should be for the spouses?
There's a very special resource that is very recent in our Army and is building and gaining momentum, and that's for our male spouses. And they have been really an ignored group, and they have challenges as well. I heard a statistic recently that 9% of our Army couples, our married Army couples, the male is the spouse and the female is the military member. But I also heard that 36% of the divorces in the Army are from that very small demographic.
Yeah, there's a lot of odd socialization things that happen, and pressures on the moms and pressures on the dads.
Absolutely.
Stay-at-home
dads, too. So I will share two resources that I recently heard about. One is MaleMilSpouse.com, and that's MaleMilSpouse.com. And then there is also a Facebook called Manning the Home Front. But these websites are full of resources for guys that are spouses. It's really terrific.
Sergeant Major of the Army Ray Chandler and Gene Chandler, thank you both very much for being with us. It was really very educational and inspiring. Thanks.
You're welcome.
My pleasure. Thank you.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. Let's hear from an identity thief.
Identities are easy to catch online. I send people an official-looking email pretending to be their bank or credit card company and ask them to confirm their personal information. Books them every time.
Safeguard your personal information on the phone, online, and especially at home, because half of identity theft occurs by someone you think you know. Keep your identity to yourself and take a bite out of crime. Learn more from the National Crime Prevention Council at ncpc.org.
A message from this station, the U.S. Department of Justice, Crime Prevention Coalition of America, and the National Crime Prevention Council.
Here with Michelle Joyner, the ever effervescent and laughing Michelle Joyner, who's the communications director for the National Military Family Association. And I've heard of you guys a little bit, and actually I'll show you a little bit later. I mentioned you a few times in my book on military fathers. But tell us what you do and why it's important.
You know, we're a nonprofit that's been around for 40 years, and we really do any work that involves the quality of life of military families. No matter what your rank is, no matter what branch of service that you're in, even if you're National Guard or reservist, we support any programs, benefits, services that improve military families' quality of life.
And you're dealing with the family members and the service members, and it doesn't make any difference who?
Primarily, we interact with military spouses. There are a lot of wonderful organizations that support service members, but I think of myself, and for a long time when my husband was in the service, I was known by the last four of his Social Security number. And so actually at our association, I'm known as Michelle Joyner. I'm a military spouse, an Army sister, an Army daughter, and so we support all military families, whether you're the parent, the service member, the sibling, aunts and uncles. There are a lot of people who really care about the well-being of the family.
So give me an example of a kind of service or a kind of reason why somebody would come to you. What would they be looking for, and what would there be available for them to take a look at?
Well, that's a good question, because we serve military families from birth to grave. And so there might be a military family who is new, and they're curious about what benefits they're eligible for, or where do I go to get an ID card. And so we have that kind of information on our website. We also support military families who maybe have an exceptional family member in their family, maybe somebody who is transitioning out of the service. We have programs for military spouses working on their education, and family retreats for families who are coming together after a long deployment. So we're an information provider, but we're also an advocate. So we've got a wealth of information on our website, which is militaryfamily.org. But you can also call us by phone, email us, or even download our new app.
And they can do the app at the app stores, various places?
Absolutely.
And where would they, what's it called?
It's My Military Life, and you can download it at the iTunes Store or Google Play, and it's free.
Excellent. So is everything else free as well? I mean, as far as the services you're providing, and you can do Operation Purple as well, right?
Right.
With the military kids. I mean, are those things, that all has to cost money, right? So where's it coming from?
Sure. It all costs money, but we are supported by generous individual donations, corporate donations, foundations, and memberships. But the information that we provide is free, our programs are free, and we don't accept any federal funding. But if you want to contribute, you can contribute through the CFC if you're a federal employee.
Now, one of the things, it's become a theme as I'm going down the aisles and talking to different organizations having to do with military families, is that there is a disconnect between what's available, the great programming that's available through organizations like National Military Family Association, and what people actually know about. How do you bridge that gap? How do you get the word out to people besides people kind of stopping randomly by with a camera?
Well, that's why we developed the app, because we found that there was that disconnect. Families needed support, they needed resources, and there were these wonderful service providers that didn't know how to connect with those families. And so we took the first step and developed an app so that military families can walk through the different stages in their life and see what programs are available. But that's one of the struggles of being a military family member, is that you don't look like a military family member because we're all just regular people. There's no uniform that we wear. And so how do folks connect and support the military families in their community? And so one of the most important things is just raising the awareness for military families in civilian communities. Let folks know that, you know, there are folks in your clubs, in your community, your neighbors, that you can always reach out to and help, but also to promote resources like ours. Download My Military Life. It'll connect you with many other nonprofit organizations. And, you know, visit Charity Navigator and other nonprofit raters to find out where are some quality programs.
What's the biggest or the most common request that you get for services?
The most common request that's you know, it changes with the times. And
I'm imagining now it probably has to do with separating, as there's going to be another 100,000 veterans who are going to be leaving the military, probably some of them a lot sooner than they wanted to. There's going to be a lot of veterans and a lot of employment issues, right?
Well, there are definitely those, but there's going to be a lot of new families that are coming in. And so as folks leave, new families are coming in with just as many questions as the ones who came in, you know, before them. And so it's making sure that military families keep the visibility in the public eye. Questions that we get often are definitely for veterans assistance and transition. It's the military spouses that are, you know, become the primary caregiver for somebody who's been injured. Where do they turn for support? It's the parents who are outside of the traditional family support system. How do I find out what's going on with my son or daughter? A lot of different things. You know, when there's a threat of government shutdown, a lot of people turn to us for the news on what's really happening. And now it's, you know, it's probably agitation that there's this huge political environment right now, and military families in wartime discussions are not even an issue that's on anybody's radar. So changes with the times, but we keep up with it.
Michelle Joyner is the Communications Director with the National Military Family Association, and the website one more time?
Militaryfamily.org.
All right, Michelle, thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.